monkey, the hummingbird comes into view, flutters and unfolds her wings, stretches forward her delicate beak towards some imaginary flower. Then we turn hard right, pursued by our own tiny shadow, as we cross the bleak scar of the Pan-American Highway and follow a trajectory that brings us over the fabulous snake-necked Alcatraz, a heron 900 feet long, conceived in the mind of a master geometer. We circle around, cross the highway for a second time, pass an astonishing arrangement of fish and triangles laid out beside a pelican, turn left and find ourselves floating over the sublime image of a giant condor with feathers extended in stylized flight. Just as I try to catch my breath, another condor, almost close enough to touch, materializes out of nowhere, a real condor this time, haughty as a fallen angel, riding a thermal back to heaven. My pilot gasps and tries to follow him. For a moment I catch a glimpse of a bright, dispassionate eye that seems to weigh us up and find us wanting. Then, like a vision from some ancient myth, the creature banks and glides contemptuously backwards into the sun, leaving our single-engine Cessna floundering in the lower air. Below us now, there's a pair of parallel lines, almost 2 miles long, arrow straight, all the way to vanishing point. And there, off to the right, a series of abstract shapes on a scale so vast, and yet so precisely executed, that it seems inconceivable they could have been the work of man. The people around here say that they were not the work of man, but of demigods, the Viracochas, who also left their fingerprints elsewhere in the Andean region many thousands of years ago. The Riddle of the Lines. The Nazca Plateau in southern Peru is a desolate place, sere and unwelcoming, barren and profitless. Human populations have never concentrated here, nor will they do so in the future. The surface of the moon seems hardly less hospitable. If you happen to be an artist with grand designs, however, these high and daunting plains look like a very promising canvas, with 200 square miles of uninterrupted tableland and the certainty that your masterwork won't be carried away on the desert breeze or covered by drifting sand. It's true that high winds do blow here, but by a happy accident of physics, they are robbed of their sting at ground level. The pebbles that litter the pampa absorb and retain the sun's heat, throwing up a protective force field of warm air. In addition, the soil contains enough gypsum to glue small stones to the subsurface, an adhesive regularly renewed by the moistening effect of early morning dews. Once things are drawn here, therefore, they tend to stay drawn. There's hardly any rain. Indeed, with less than half an hour of miserly drizzle every decade, Nazca is among the driest places on Earth. If you're an artist, therefore, if you have something grand and important to express, and if you want it to be visible forever, these strange and lonely flatlands could look like the answer to your prayers. Experts have pronounced upon the antiquity of Nazca, basing their opinions on fragments of pottery found embedded in the lines and on radiocarbon results from various organic remains unearthed here. The dates conjectured range between 350 BC and AD 600. Realistically, they tell us nothing about the age of the lines themselves, which are inherently as undateable as the stones cleared to make them. All we can say for sure is that the most recent are at least 1,400 years old, but it is theoretically possible that they could be far more ancient than that, for the simple reason that the artifacts from which such dates are derived could have been brought to Nazca by later peoples. The majority of the designs are spread out across a clearly defined area of southern Peru, bounded by the Rio Ingenio to the north and the Rio Nazca to the south, a roughly square canvas of dun-colored desert with 46 kilometers of the Pan-American Highway running obliquely through it from top center to bottom right. Here, scattered apparently at random, are literally hundreds of different figures. Some depict animals and birds, a total of 18 different birds, but far more take the form of geometrical devices, in the form of trapezoids, rectangles, triangles and straight lines. Viewed from above, these latter resemble, to the modern eye, a jumble of runways, as though some megalomaniac civil engineer had been licensed to act out his most flamboyant fantasies of airfield design. It therefore comes as no surprise, since humans are not supposed to have been able to fly until the beginning of the 20th century, that the Nazca lines have been identified by a number of observers as landing strips for alien spaceships. This is a seductive notion, but Nazca is perhaps not the best place to seek evidence for it. For example, it is difficult to understand why extraterrestrials advanced enough to have crossed hundreds of light-years of interstellar space should have needed landing strips at all. Surely such beings would have mastered the technology of setting their flying saucers down vertically. Besides, there's really no question of the Nazca lines ever having been used as runways by flying saucers or anything else, although some of them look like that from above. Viewed at ground level, they are little more than grazes on the surface made by scraping away thousands of tons of black volcanic pebbles to expose the desert's paler base of yellow sand and clay. None of the cleared areas is more than a few inches deep, and all are much too soft to have permitted the landing of wheeled flying vehicles. The German mathematician Maria Reiche, who devoted half a century to the study of the lines, was only being logical when she dismissed the extraterrestrial theory with a single, pithy sentence a few years ago. "I'm afraid the spacemen would have gotten stuck." If not runways for the chariots of alien gods, therefore, what else might the Nazca lines be? The truth is that no one knows their purpose, just as no one really knows their age. They are a genuine mystery of the past, and the closer you look at them, the more baffling they become. It's clear, for example, that the animals and birds antedate the geometry of the runways, because many of the trapezoids, rectangles, and straight lines bisect, and thus partially obliterate, the more complex figures. The obvious deduction is that the final artwork of the desert as we view it today must have been produced in two phases. Moreover, though it seems contrary to the normal laws of technical progress, we must concede that the earlier of the two phases was the more advanced. The execution of the zoomorphic figures called for far higher levels of skill and technology than the etching of the straight lines. But how widely separated in time were the earlier and later artists? Scholars do not address themselves to this question. Instead, they lump both cultures together as the Nazcans and depict them as primitive tribesmen who unaccountably developed sophisticated techniques of artistic self-expression and then vanished from the Peruvian scene many hundreds of years before the appearance of their better-known successors, the Incas. How sophisticated were these Nazcan primitives? What kind of knowledge must they have possessed to inscribe their gigantic signatures on the plateau? It seems, for a start, that they were pretty good observational astronomers, at least according to Dr. Phyllis Pitluga, an astronomer with the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. After making an intensive computer-aided study of stellar alignments at Nazca, she has concluded that the famous spider figure was devised as a terrestrial diagram of the giant constellation of Orion, and that the arrow straight lines linked to the figure appear to have been set out to track through the ages the changing declinations of the three stars of Orion's belt. The real significance of Dr. Pitluga's discovery will become apparent in due course. Meanwhile, let us note that the Nazca spider also accurately depicts a member of a known spider genus, Ricinulae. This, as it happens, is one of the rarest spider genera in the world. So rare, indeed, that it has only been found in remote and inaccessible parts of the Amazon rainforest. How did the supposedly primitive Nazcan artists travel so far from their homeland, crossing the formidable barrier of the Andes, to obtain a specimen? More to the point, why should they have wanted to do such a thing? And how were they able to duplicate minute details of Ricinulae's anatomy normally visible only under a microscope, notably the reproductive organ positioned on the end of its extended right leg? Such mysteries multiply at Nazca, and none of the designs, except perhaps the condor, really seem quite at home here. The whale and the monkey are, after all, as out of place in this desert environment as the Amazonian spider. A curious figure of a man, his right arm raised as though in greeting, heavy boots on his feet and round eyes staring owlishly forward, cannot be said to belong to any known era or culture. And other drawings depicting the human form are equally peculiar. Their heads enclosed in halos of radiance, they do indeed look like visitors from another planet. Their sheer size is equally noteworthy and bizarre. The hummingbird is 165 feet long, the spider 150 feet long, the condor stretches nearly 400 feet from beak to tail feathers, as does the pelican, and a lizard, whose tail is now divided by the Pan American Highway, is 617 feet in length. Almost every design is executed on the same cyclopean scale and in the same difficult manner by the careful contouring of a single continuous line. Similar attention to detail is to be found in the geometrical devices. Some of these take the form of straight lines more than 5 miles long, marching like Roman roads across the desert, dropping into dried-out riverbeds, surmounting rocky outcrops, and never once deviating from true. This kind of precision is hard, but not impossible, to explain in conventional, common-sense terms. More puzzling by far are the zoomorphic figures. How could they have been so perfectly made when, without aircraft, their creators could not have checked the progress of their work by viewing it in its proper perspective? None of the designs is small enough to be seen from ground level, where they appear merely as a series of shapeless ruts in the desert. They show their true form only when seen from an altitude of several hundred feet. There is no elevation nearby that provides such a vantage point. Line makers, map makers. I'm flying over the lines, trying to make sense of it all. My pilot is Rodolfo Arias, lately of the Peruvian Air Force. After a career in jet fighters, he finds the little Cessna slow and uninspiring and treats it like a taxi with wings. Once already, we've been back to the airstrip at Nazca to remove a window so that my partner Santha can point her cameras vertically down at the alluring glyphs. Now we're experimenting with the view from different altitudes. At a couple of hundred feet above the plane, Ricinulae, the Amazonian spider, looks like he's going to rear up and snatch us in his jaws. At 500 feet, we can see several of the figures at once. A dog, a tree, a weird pair of hands, the condor, and some of the triangles and trapezoids. When we ascend to 1,500 feet, the zoomorphs, hitherto predominant, are revealed merely as small scattered units surrounded by an astonishing scribble of vast geometric forms. These forms now look less like runways and more like pathways made by giants. Pathways that crisscross the plateau in what seems at first a bewildering variety of shapes, angles, and sizes. As the ground continues to recede, however, and as the widening perspective on the lines permits more of an eagle's eye view, I begin to wonder whether there might not, after all, be some method to the cuneiform slashes and scratches spread out below me. I am reminded of an observation made by Maria Reike, the mathematician who has lived at Nazca and studied the lines since 1946. In her view, the geometric drawings give the impression of a cipher script in which the same words are sometimes written in huge letters, at another time in minute characters. There are line arrangements which appear in a great variety of size categories, together with very similar shapes. All the drawings are composed of a certain number of basic elements. As the Cessna bumps and heaves across the heavens, I also remember it is no accident that the Nazca lines were only properly identified in the 20th century, after the era of flight had begun. In the late 16th century, a magistrate named Luis de Monzon was the first Spanish traveller to bring back eyewitness reports concerning these mysterious marks on the desert, and to collect the strange local traditions that linked them to the Viracochas. However, until commercial airlines began to operate regularly between Lima and Arequipa in the 1930s, no one seems to have grasped that the largest piece of graphic art in the world lay here in southern Peru. It was the development of aviation that made the difference, giving men and women the godlike ability to take to the skies and see beautiful and puzzling things that had hitherto been hidden from them. Rodolfo is steering the Cessna in a gentle circle over the figure of the monkey, a big monkey tied in a riddle of geometric forms. It's not easy to describe the eerie, hypnotic feeling this design gives me. It's very complicated and absorbing to look at, and slightly sinister in an abstract, indefinable way. The monkey's body is defined by a continuous unbroken line, and without ever being interrupted, this same line winds upstairs, over pyramids, into a series of zigzags, through a spiral labyrinth, the tail, and then back around a number of stair-like hairpin bends. It would be a real tour de force of draftsmanship and artistic skill on a sheet of notepaper. But this is the Nazca Desert, where they do things on a grand scale, and the monkey is at least 400 feet long and 300 feet wide. Were the line makers map makers too? And why were they called the Viracochas? Chapter 5. The Inca Trail to the Past. No artifacts or monuments, no cities or temples, have endured in recognizable form for longer than the most resilient religious traditions. Whether expressed in the pyramid texts of ancient Egypt, or the Hebrew Bible, or the Vedas, such traditions are among the most imperishable of all human creations. They are vehicles of knowledge, voyaging through time. The last custodians of the ancient religious heritage of Peru were the Incas, whose beliefs and idolatry were extirpated and whose treasures were ransacked during the 30 terrible years that followed the Spanish conquest in AD 1532. Providentially, however, a number of early Spanish travelers made sincere efforts to document Inca traditions before they were entirely forgotten. Though little attention was paid at the time, some of these traditions speak strikingly of a great civilization that was believed to have existed in Peru many thousands of years earlier. Powerful memories were preserved of this civilization, said to have been founded by the Viracochas, the same mysterious beings credited with the making of the Nazca lines. Foam of the Sea. When the Spanish conquistadors arrived, the Inca Empire extended along the Pacific coast and Andean highlands of South America. From the northern border of modern Ecuador, through the whole of Peru, and as far south as the Maule River in central Chile, connecting the far-flung corners of this empire was a vast and sophisticated road system. Two parallel north-south highways, for example, one running for 3,600 kilometers along the coast and the other for a similar distance through the Andes. Both these great thoroughfares were paved and connected by frequent links. In addition, they exhibited an interesting range of design and engineering features, such as suspension bridges and tunnels cut through solid rock. They were clearly the work of an evolved, disciplined, and ambitious society. Ironically, they played a significant part in its downfall. The Spanish forces, led by Francisco Pizarro, used them to great effect to speed up their ruthless advance into the Inca heartland. The capital of the Inca Empire was the city of Cusco, a name meaning the Earth's Navel in the local Quechua language. According to legend, it was established by Manco Capac and Mama Oclo, two children of the sun. Here, though the Incas worshipped the sun god whom they knew as Inti, quite another deity was venerated as the most holy of all. This was Viracocha, whose namesakes were said to have made the Nazca lines and whose own name meant foam of the sea. No doubt it is just a coincidence that the Greek goddess Aphrodite, who was born of the sea, received her name because of the foam, Aphros, out of which she was formed. Besides, Viracocha was always depicted uncompromisingly as a male by the peoples of the Andes. That much about him is known for certain. No historian, however, is able to say how ancient was the cult of this deity before the Spanish arrived to put a stop to it. This is because the cult seemed always to have been around. Indeed, long before the Incas incorporated him into their cosmogony and built a magnificent temple for him at Cuzco, the evidence suggests that the high god Viracocha had been worshipped by all the civilizations that had ever existed in the long history of Peru. Citadel of Viracocha. A few days after leaving Nazca, Santa and I arrived in Cuzco and made our way to the site of the Coricancha, the great temple dedicated to Viracocha in the pre-Columbian era. The Coricancha was, of course, long gone, or to be more exact, it was not so much gone as buried beneath layers of later architecture. The Spanish kept its superb Inca foundations and the lower parts of its fabulously strong walls, and had erected their own grandiose colonial cathedral on top. Walking towards the front entrance of this cathedral, I remembered that the Inca temple that had once stood here had been covered with more than 700 sheets of pure gold, each weighing about 2 kilograms, and that its spacious courtyard had been planted with fields of replica corn, also fashioned out of gold. I could not help but be reminded of Solomon's temple in far-off Jerusalem, also reputed to have been adorned with sheets of gold and a marvelous orchard of golden trees. Earthquakes in 1650 and again in 1950 had largely demolished the Spanish cathedral of Santo Domingo, which stood on the site of the Temple of Viracocha, and it had been necessary to rebuild it on both occasions. Its Inca foundations and lower walls survived these natural disasters intact, thanks to their characteristic design, which made use of an elegant system of interlocking polygonal blocks. These blocks, and the general layout of the place, were almost all that was now left of the original structure, apart from an octagonal grey stone platform at the centre of the vast rectangular courtyard, which had once been covered with 55 kilograms of solid gold. On either side of the courtyard were antechambers, also from the Inca temple, with refined architectural features such as walls that tapered upwards and beautifully carved niches hewn out of single pieces of granite. We took a walk through the narrow, cobbled streets of Cuzco. Looking around, I realized it was not just the cathedral that reflected Spanish imposition on top of an earlier culture. The whole town was slightly schizophrenic. Spacious, balconied, pastel-shaded colonial homes and palaces towered above me, but almost all of them stood on Inca foundations or incorporated complete Inca structures of the same beautiful polygonal architecture used in the Coricancha. In one alleyway, known as Hatun Rumiyoc, I paused to examine an intricate jigsaw puzzle of a wall made of countless dry stone blocks, all perfectly fitted together, all of different sizes and shapes, interlocking in a bewildering array of angles. The carving of the individual blocks and their arrangement into so complicated a structure could only have been achieved by master craftsmen, possessed of very high levels of skill, with untold centuries of architectural experimentation behind them. On one block, I counted 12 angles and sides in a single plane, and I could not slip even the edge of a piece of thin paper into the joints that connected it to the surrounding blocks. The Bearded Stranger. It seemed that in the early 16th century, before the Spanish began to demolish Peruvian culture in earnest, an idol of Viracocha had stood in the Holy of Holies of the Coricancha. According to a contemporary text, this idol took the form of a marble statue of the god, a statue described as to the hair, complexion, features, raiment, and sandals, just as the painters represent the Apostle Saint Bartholomew. Other accounts of Viracocha likened his appearance to that of St. Thomas. I examined a number of illustrated ecclesiastical manuscripts in which these two saints appeared. Both were routinely depicted as lean, bearded, white men, past middle age, wearing sandals and dressed in long flowing cloaks. As we shall see, the records confirmed this was exactly the appearance ascribed to Viracocha by those who worshipped him. Whoever he was, therefore, he could not have been an American Indian. They are relatively dark-skinned people with sparse facial hair. Viracocha's bushy beard and pale complexion made him sound like a Caucasian. Back in the 16th century, the Incas had thought so too. Indeed, their legends and religious beliefs made them so certain of his physical type that they initially mistook the white and bearded Spaniards who arrived on their shores for the returning Viracocha and his demigods, an event long prophesied, and which Viracocha was said in all the legends to have promised. This happy coincidence gave Pizarro's conquistadors the decisive strategic and psychological edge that they needed to overcome the numerically superior Inca forces in the battles that followed. Who had provided the model for the Viracochas? Chapter 6. He came in a time of chaos. Through all the ancient legends of the peoples of the Andes, stalked a tall, bearded, pale-skinned figure, wrapped in a cloak of secrecy. And though he was known by many different names, in many different places, he was always recognizably the same figure. Viracocha, foam of the sea, a master of science and magic who wielded terrible weapons, and who came in a time of chaos to set the world to rights. The same basic story was shared in many variants by all the peoples of the Andean region. It began with a vivid description of a terrifying period when the earth had been inundated by a great flood and plunged into darkness by the disappearance of the sun. Society had fallen into disorder, and the people suffered much hardship. Then, there suddenly appeared, coming from the south, a white man of large stature and authoritative demeanor. This man had such great power that he changed the hills into valleys and from the valleys made great hills, causing streams to flow from the living stone. The early Spanish chronicler who recorded this tradition explained that it had been told to him by the Indians he had traveled among on his journeys in the Andes. And they heard it from their fathers, who in their turn had it from old songs which were handed down from very ancient times. They say that this man traveled along the highland route to the north, working marvels as he went, and that they never saw him again. They say that in many places he gave men instructions how they should live, speaking to them with great love and kindness, and admonishing them to be good and to do no damage or injury to one another, but to love one another and show charity to all. In most places they name him Tiki Viracocha. Other names applied to the same figure included Huaracocha, Con, Contiki, Tunupa, Tapac, Tupaca, and Ila. He was a scientist, an architect of surpassing skills, a sculptor and an engineer. He caused terraces and fields to be formed on the steep sides of ravines and sustaining walls to rise up and support them. He also made irrigating channels to flow, and he went in various directions, arranging many things. Viracocha was also a teacher and a healer, and made himself helpful to people in need. It was said that whenever he passed, he healed all that were sick and restored sight to the blind. This gentle, civilizing, superhuman Samaritan had another side to his nature, however. If his life were threatened, as it seems to have been on several occasions, he had the weapon of heavenly fire at his disposal. Working great miracles, by his words, he came to the district of Canas, and there, near a village called Cacha, the people rose up against him and threatened to stone him. They saw him sink to his knees and raise his hands to heaven as if beseeching aid in the peril which beset him. The Indians declare that thereupon they saw fire in the sky, which seemed all around them. Full of fear, they approached him whom they had intended to kill, and besought him to forgive them. Presently they saw that the fire was extinguished at his command. Those stones were consumed by fire in such wise that large blocks could be lifted by hand as if they were cork. They narrate further that leaving the place where this occurred, he came to the coast, and there, holding his mantle, he went forth amidst the waves and was seen no more. And as he went, they gave him the name Viracocha, which means foam of the sea. The legends were unanimous in their physical description of Viracocha. In his Summa y Narración de los Incas, for example, Juan de Betanzos, a 16th century Spanish chronicler, stated that according to the Indians, he had been a bearded man of tall stature, clothed in a white robe that came down to his feet and which he wore belted at the waist. Other descriptions, collected from many different and widely separated Andean peoples, all seem to identify the same enigmatic individual. According to one, he was a bearded man of medium height, dressed in a rather long cloak. He was past his prime, with grey hair and lean. He walked with a staff and addressed the natives with love, calling them his sons and daughters. As he traversed all the land, he worked miracles. He healed the sick by touch. He spoke every tongue, even better than the natives. They called him Tunupa, or Tarpaca, Viracocha Rapacha, or Pachacan. In one legend, Tunupa Viracocha was said to have been a white man of large stature, whose air and person aroused great respect and veneration. In another, he was described as a white man of august appearance, blue-eyed, bearded, without headgear, and wearing a kusma, a jerkin or sleeveless shirt reaching to the knees. In yet another, which seemed to refer to a later phase of his life, he was revered as a wise counselor in matters of state and depicted as an old man, with a beard and long hair, wearing a long tunic. Civilizing mission. Above all else, Viracocha was remembered in the legends as a teacher. Before his coming, it was said, men lived in a condition of disorder. Many went naked like savages. They had no houses or other dwellings than caves, and from these they went forth to gather whatever they could find to eat in the countryside. Viracocha was credited with changing all this, and with initiating the long-lost golden age, which later generations looked back on with nostalgia. All the legends agreed, furthermore, that he had carried out his civilizing mission with great kindness, and as far as possible had abjured the use of force. Careful instruction and personal example had been the main methods used to equip the people with the techniques and knowledge necessary for a cultured and productive life. In particular, he was remembered for bringing to Peru such varied skills as medicine, metallurgy, farming, animal husbandry, the art of writing, said by the Incas to have been introduced by Viracocha but later forgotten, and a sophisticated understanding of the principles of engineering and architecture. I had already been impressed by the quality of Inca stonework in Cuzco. As my research in the old town continued, however, I was surprised to discover that by no means all the so-called Inca masonry could be attributed with any degree of archaeological certainty to the Incas. It was true that they had been masters in the manipulation of stone, and many monuments in the Cuzco area were indisputably their work. It seemed, however, that some of the more remarkable structures routinely attributed to them could have been erected by earlier civilizations. The evidence suggested that the Incas had often functioned as the restorers of these structures, rather than their original builders. The same appeared to be true of the highly developed system of roads connecting the far-flung parts of the Inca Empire. The reader will recall that these roads took the form of parallel highways, running north to south, one along the coast and the other through the Andes. All in all, more than 15,000 miles of surfaced tracks had been in regular and efficient use before the time of the Spanish conquest, and I had assumed that the Incas had been responsible for all of them. I now learn that it was much more likely that they had inherited the system. Their role had been to restore, maintain, and unify a pre-existing network. Indeed, though it was not often admitted, no expert could safely estimate how old these incredible highways were, or who had built them. The mystery was deepened by local traditions which stated not only that the road system and the sophisticated architecture had been ancient in the time of the Incas, but that both were the work of white, auburn-haired men who had lived thousands of years earlier. One legend described Viracocha as being accompanied by messengers of two kinds, faithful soldiers and shining ones. Their role was to carry their lord's message to every part of the world. Elsewhere, there were phrases such as, Kon-Tiki returned with a number of attendants. Kon-Tiki then summoned his followers, who were called Viracocha. Kon-Tiki commanded all but two of the Viracocha to go east. There came forth from a lake a lord named Kon-Tiki Viracocha, bringing with him a certain number of people. Thus those Viracochas went off to the various districts which Viracocha had indicated for them. The work of demons. The ancient citadel of Sacsayhuaman lies just north of Cusco. We reached it late one afternoon under a sky almost occluded by heavy clouds of tarnished silver. A cold, grey breeze was blowing across the high-altitude tundra as I clambered up stairways, through lintelled stone gates built for giants, and walked along the mammoth rows of zigzag walls. I craned my neck and looked up at a big granite boulder that my route now passed under, 12 feet high, 7 feet across, and weighing considerably more than 100 tons. It was a work of man, not of nature. It had been cut and shaped into a symphonic harmony of angles, manipulated with apparent ease, as though it were made of wax or putty, and stood on its end in a wall of other huge and problematic polygonal blocks, some of them positioned above it, some below it, some to each side, and all in perfectly balanced and well-ordered juxtaposition. Since one of these astonishing pieces of carefully hewn stone had a height of 28 feet and was calculated to weigh 361 tons, roughly the equivalent of 500 family-sized automobiles, it seemed to me that a number of fundamental questions were crying out for answers. How had the Incas, or their predecessors, been able to work stone on such a gargantuan scale? How had they cut and shaped these cyclopean boulders so precisely? How had they transported them tens of miles from distant quarries? By what means had they made walls of them, shuffling the individual blocks around and raising them high above the ground with such apparent ease? These people weren't even supposed to have had the wheel, let alone machinery capable of lifting and manipulating dozens of irregularly shaped 100-ton blocks and sorting them into three-dimensional jigsaw puzzles. I knew that the chroniclers of the early colonial period had been as perplexed as I was by what they had seen. The respected Garcilaso de la Vega, for example, who came here in the 16th century, had spoken with awe about the fortress of Sacsayhuaman. Its proportions are inconceivable when one has not actually seen it, and when one has looked at it closely and examined it attentively, they appear to be so extraordinary that it seems as though some magic had presided over its construction, that it must be the work of demons instead of human beings. It is made of such great stones, and in such great number, that one wonders simultaneously how the Indians were able to quarry them, how they transported them, and how they hewed them and set them one on top of the other with such precision. For they disposed of neither iron nor steel with which to penetrate the rock and cut and polish the stones. They had neither wagon nor oxen to transport them, and in fact there exist neither wagons nor oxen throughout the world that would have sufficed for this task. So enormous are these stones, and so rude the mountain paths over which they were conveyed. Garcilaso also reported something else interesting. In his royal commentaries of the Incas, he gave an account of how, in historical times, an Inca king had tried to emulate the achievements of his predecessors who had built Sacsayhuaman. The attempt had involved bringing just one immense boulder from several miles away to add to the existing fortifications. This boulder was hauled across the mountain by more than 20,000 Indians, going up and down very steep hills. At a certain spot, it fell from their hands over a precipice, crushing more than 3,000 men. In all the histories I surveyed, this was the only report which described the Incas actually building, or trying to build, with huge blocks like those employed at Sacsayhuaman. The report suggested that they possessed no experience of the techniques involved, and that their attempt had ended in disaster. This, of course, proved nothing in itself, but Garcilaso's story did intensify my doubts about the great fortifications which towered above me. As I looked at them, I felt that they could indeed have been erected before the age of the Incas, and by some infinitely older and more technically advanced race. Not for the first time, I was reminded of how difficult archaeologists found it to provide accurate dates for engineering works like roads and dry stone walls, which contained no organic compounds. Radiocarbon was redundant in such circumstances. Thermoluminescence too was useless. And while promising new tests, such as chlorine-36 rock exposure dating, were now being developed, their implementation was still some way off. Pending further advances in the latter field, therefore, expert chronology was still largely the result of guesswork and subjective assumptions. Since it was known that the Incas had made intensive use of Sacsayhuaman, I could easily understand why it had been assumed that they had built it. But there was no obvious or necessary connection between these two propositions. The Incas could just as well have found the structures already in place and moved into them. If so, who had the original builders been? The Viracochas, said the ancient myths, the bearded, white-skinned strangers, the shining ones, the faithful soldiers. As we traveled, I continued to study the accounts of the Spanish adventurers and ethnographers of the 16th and 17th centuries, who had faithfully recorded the ancient pre-contact traditions of the Peruvian Indians. What was particularly noticeable about these traditions was the repeated emphasis that the coming of the Viracochas had been associated with a terrible deluge, which had overwhelmed the earth and destroyed the greater part of humanity. Chapter 7. Were there giants then? Just after 6 in the morning, the little train jerked into motion and began its slow climb up the steep sides of the Valley of Cusco. The narrow-gauge tracks were laid out in a series of Z shapes. We chugged along the lower horizontal of the first Z, then shunted and went backwards up the oblique, shunted again and went forward along the upper horizontal, and so on, with numerous stops and starts, following a route that eventually took us high above the ancient city. The Inca walls and colonial palaces, the narrow streets, the Cathedral of Santo Domingo, squatting atop the ruins of Viracocha's temple, all looked spectral and surreal in the pearl-grey light of a dawn sky. A fairy pattern of electric lamps still decorated the streets. A thin mist seeped across the ground, and the smoke of domestic fires rose from the chimneys over the tiled roofs and countless small houses. Eventually, the train turned its back on Cusco, and we proceeded for a while in a straight northwesterly direction towards our destination, Machu Picchu, the lost city of the Incas, some 3 hours and 130 kilometers away. I had intended to read, but lulled by the rocking motion of the carriage, I dropped off to sleep instead. 50 minutes later, I awoke to find that we were passing through a painting. The foreground, brightly sunlit, consisted of flat green meadows sprinkled with little patches of thawing frost, distributed on either side of a stream across a long, wide valley. In the middle of my view, dotted with bushes, was a large field, on which a handful of black and white dairy cows grazed. Nearby was a scattered settlement of houses, outside which stood small, dark-skinned Quechua Indians, dressed in ponchos, balaclavas, and colorful woolen hats. More distant were slopes canopied in fir trees and exotic eucalyptus. My eye followed the rising contours of a pair of high green mountains, which then parted to reveal folded and even more lofty uplands. Beyond these soared a far horizon, surmounted by a jagged range of radiant and snowy peaks. Casting down the giants. It was with understandable reluctance that I turned at last to my reading. I wanted to look more closely at some of the curious links I thought I had identified connecting the sudden appearance of Viracocha to the deluge legends of the Incas and other Andean peoples. Before me was a passage from Father José de Acosta's Natural and Moral History of the Indies, in which the learned priest set out what the Indians themselves report of their beginning. They make great mention of a deluge which happened in their country. The Indians say that all men were drowned in the deluge, and they report that out of Lake Titicaca came one Viracocha, who stayed in Tiwanaku, where at this day there are to be seen the ruins of ancient and very strange buildings, and from thence came to Cusco, and so began mankind to multiply. Making a mental note to find out more about Lake Titicaca and the mysterious Tiwanaku, I read the following passage summarizing a legend from the Cusco area. For some crime unstated, the people who lived in the most ancient times were destroyed by the Creator in a deluge. After the deluge, the Creator appeared in human form from Lake Titicaca. He then created the sun and moon and stars. After that, he renewed the human population of the earth. In another myth, the great creator god Viracocha decided to make a world for men to live in. First he made the earth and sky. Then he began to make people to live in it, carving great stone figures of giants which he brought to life. At first all went well, but after a time the giants began to fight among themselves and refused to work. Viracocha decided that he must destroy them. Some he turned back into stone. The rest he overwhelmed with a great flood. Very similar notions were, of course, found in other quite unconnected sources, such as the Jewish Old Testament. In chapter 6 of the book of Genesis, for example, which describes the Hebrew God's displeasure with his creation and his decision to destroy it, I had long been intrigued by one of the few descriptive statements made about the forgotten era before the flood. According to the enigmatic language of that statement, there were giants in the earth in those days. Could the giants, buried in the biblical sands of the Middle East, be connected in some unseen way to the giants woven into the fabric of pre-Columbian Native American legends? Adding considerably to the mystery was the fact that the Jewish and Peruvian sources both went on, with many further details in common, to depict an angry deity unleashing a catastrophic flood upon a wicked and disobedient world. On the next page of the sheaf of documents I had assembled was this Inca account of the deluge, handed down by a certain Father Molina. In the life of Manco Capac, who was the first Inca, and from whom they began to boast themselves children of the sun, and from whom they derived their idolatrous worship of the sun, they had an ample account of the deluge. They say that in it perished all races of men and created things, insomuch that the waters rose above the highest mountain peaks in the world. No living thing survived except a man and a woman who remained in a box, and when the waters subsided, the wind carried them to Tiwanaku, where the Creator began to raise up the people and the nations that are in that region. Garcilaso de la Vega, the son of a Spanish nobleman, and an Inca royal woman, was already familiar to me from his royal commentaries of the Incas. He was regarded as one of the most reliable chroniclers of the traditions of his mother's people, and had done his work in the 16th century, soon after the conquest, when those traditions had not yet been contaminated by foreign influences. He too confirmed what had obviously been a universal and deeply impressed belief. After the waters of the deluge had subsided, a certain man appeared in the country of Tiwanaku. That man had been Viracocha. Wrapped in his cloak, he was strong and august of countenance, and walked with unassailable confidence through the most dangerous badlands. He worked miracles of healing, and could call down fire from heaven. To the Indians, it must have seemed that he had materialized from nowhere. Ancient traditions. We were now more than 2 hours into our journey to Machu Picchu, and the panorama had changed. Huge black mountains, upon which not a trace of snow remained to reflect the sunlight, towered darkly above us, and we seemed to be running through a rocky defile at the end of a narrow valley, filled with somber shadows. The air was cold, and so were my feet. I shivered and resumed reading. One thing was obvious, amid the confused web of legends I'd reviewed, legends which supplemented one another, but also at times conflicted. All the scholars agreed that the Incas had borrowed, absorbed, and passed on the traditions of many of the different civilized peoples over whom they had extended their control during the centuries of expansion of their vast empire. In this sense, whatever the outcome of the historical debate over the antiquity of the Incas themselves, nobody could seriously dispute their role as transmitters of the ancient belief systems of all the great archaic cultures, coastal and highland, known and unknown, that had preceded them in this land. And who could say just what civilizations might have existed in Peru in the unexplored regions of the past? Every year, archaeologists come up with new finds, which extend the horizons further and further back in time. So why shouldn't they one day discover evidence of the penetration into the Andes, in remote antiquity, of a race of civilizers who had come from overseas and gone away again after completing their work? That was what the legends seemed to me to be suggesting. Legends that most of all, and most clearly, had immortalized the memory of the man-god Viracocha, striding the high, windswept byways of the Andes, working miracles wherever he went. Viracocha himself, with his two assistants, journeyed north. He travelled up the Cordillera, one assistant went along the coast, and the other up the edge of the eastern forests. The creator proceeded to Urcos, near Cuzco, where he commanded the future population to emerge from a mountain. He visited Cuzco, and then continued north to Ecuador. There, in the coastal province of Manta, he took leave of his people and, walking on the waves, disappeared across the ocean. There was always this poignant moment of goodbye, at the end of every folk memory, featuring the remarkable stranger whose name meant Foam of the Sea. Viracocha went on his way, calling forth the races of men. When he came to the district of Puerto Viejo, he was joined by his followers, whom he had sent on before. And when he had joined them, he put to sea in their company, and they say that he and his people went by water, as easily as they had traversed the land. Always this poignant goodbye, and often a hint of science or magic. Time capsule. Outside the window of the train, things were happening. To my left, swollen with dark water, I could see the Urubamba, a tributary of the Amazon and a river sacred to the Incas. The air temperature had warmed up noticeably. We had descended into a relatively low-lying valley with its own tropical microclimate. The mountain slopes rising on either side of the tracks were densely covered in green forests, and I was reminded that this was truly a region of vast and virtually insuperable obstacles. Whoever had ventured all this way into the middle of nowhere to build Machu Picchu must have had a very strong motive for doing so. Whatever the reason had been, the choice of such a remote location had at least one beneficial side effect. Machu Picchu was never found by the conquistadors and friars during their days of destructive zeal. Indeed, it was not until 1911, when the fabulous heritage of older races was beginning to be treated with greater respect, that a young American explorer, Hiram Bingham, revealed Machu Picchu to the world. It was realized at once that this incredible site opened a unique window on pre-Columbian civilization. In consequence, the ruins were protected from looters and souvenir hunters, and an important chunk of the enigmatic past was preserved to amaze future generations. Having passed through a one-horse town named Agua Caliente, which means hot water, where a few broken-down restaurants and cheap bars leered at travelers from beside the tracks, we reached Machu Picchu, Puentes Ruinas station at 9:10 in the morning. From here, a half-hour bus ride on a winding dirt road up the side of a steep and forbidding mountain brought us to Machu Picchu itself, to the ruins, and to a bad hotel, which charged us a nonsensical amount of money for a not very clean room. We were the only guests. Though it had been years since the local guerrilla movement had last bombed the Machu Picchu train, not many foreigners were keen to come here anymore. Machu Picchu dreaming. It was 2 in the afternoon. I stood on a high point at the southern end of the site. The ruins stretched out northwards, in lichen-enshrouded terraces before me. Thick clouds were wrapped in a ring around the mountaintops, but the sunlight still occasionally burst through here and there. Way down on the valley floor, I could see the sacred river, curled in a hairpin loop, right around the central formation on which Machu Picchu was based, like a moat surrounding a giant castle. The river showed deep green from this vantage point, reflecting the greenness of the steep jungle slopes, and there were patches of white water and wonderful sparkling gleams of light. I gazed across the ruins towards the dominant peak. Its name is Huayna Picchu, and it used to feature in all the classic travel agency posters of this site. To my astonishment, I now observed that for 100 meters or so below its summit, it had been neatly terraced and sculpted. Somebody had been up there and had carefully raked the near-vertical cliffs into a graceful hanging garden, which had perhaps in ancient times been planted with bright flowers. It seemed to me that the entire site, together with its setting, was a monumental work of sculpture, composed in part of mountains, in part of rock, in part of trees, in part of stones, and also in part of water. It was a heart-achingly beautiful place, certainly one of the most beautiful places I have ever seen. Despite its luminous brilliance, however, I felt I was gazing down onto a city of ghosts. It was like the wreck of the Marie Celeste, deserted and restless. The houses were arranged in long terraces. Each house was tiny, with just one room fronting directly onto the narrow street, and the architecture was solid and functional, but by no means ornate. By way of contrast, certain ceremonial areas were engineered to an infinitely higher standard and incorporated giant blocks, similar to those I had seen at Sacsayhuaman. One smoothly polished polygonal monolith was around 12 feet long by 5 feet wide by 5 feet thick and could not have weighed less than 200 tons. How had the ancient builders managed to get it up here? There were dozens of others like it, too, and they were all arranged in the familiar jigsaw puzzle walls of interlocking angles. On one block, I was able to count a total of 33 angles, every one of them intermeshed faultlessly with a matching angle on an adjoining block. There were massive polygons and perfect ashlars with razor-sharp edges. There were also natural, unhewn boulders integrated into the overall design at a number of points, and there were strange and unusual devices, such as the Intihuatana, the hitching post of the sun. This remarkable artifact consisted of an elemental chunk of bedrock, gray and crystalline, carved into a complex geometrical form of curves and angles, incised niches and external buttresses, surmounted at the center by a stubby vertical prong. Jigsaw puzzle. How old is Machu Picchu? The academic consensus is that the city could not have been built much earlier than the 15th century AD. Dissenting opinions, however, have from time to time been expressed by a number of more daring but respectable scholars. In the 1930s, for example, Rolf Müller, professor of astronomy at the University of Potsdam, found convincing evidence to suggest that the most important features of Machu Picchu possessed significant astronomical alignments. From these, through the use of detailed mathematical computations concerning star positions in the sky in previous millennia, which gradually altered down the epochs as the result of a phenomenon known as precession of the equinoxes, Müller concluded that the original layout of the site could only have been accomplished during the era of 4000 BC to 2000 BC. In terms of orthodox history, this was a heresy of audacious proportions. If Müller was right, Machu Picchu was not a mere 500, but could be as much as 6000 years old. This would make it significantly older than the Great Pyramid of Egypt, assuming, of course, that one accepted the Great Pyramid's own orthodox dating of around 2500 BC. There were other dissenting voices concerning the antiquity of Machu Picchu, and most, like Mueller, were convinced that parts of the site were thousands of years older than the date favored by Orthodox historians. Like the big polygonal blocks that made up the walls, this was a notion that looked as though it might fit with other pieces of a jigsaw